Hello, welcome Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Sali, and today we reflect on the recent controversial American presidential elections from an African perspective. Joining me today are three distinguished guests. Catherine Gibson, my colleague, VOA congressional correspondent. She joins me from Washington. And Pauline Muchina, a public education and advocacy coordinator for Africa region at the American Friends Committee. She joins us from Alexandria, Virginia. And last but not least, Claude Gatebuche, Executive Director of the Africa Great Lakes Action Network. He joins us from Nashville, the great U.S. state of Tennessee. But first, we'll have to go to Catherine Gibson, my colleague, the VOA congressional correspondent, to give us a sense of what happened during the last elections, which are being characterized as controversial. Catherine, why are these elections, referred to as controversial presidential elections?
Well, you know, a lot of it is the rhetoric that former President Trump was using in the lead up to Election Day here in the United States last November. A lot of journalists here in the United States had been asking Mr. Trump, if the results of the election are contested, will you stand down? Will you fight them? What will you do? You know, we have a tradition here in the United States of a peaceful transfer of power. We had a very contested election in 2000 when Al Gore lost to George W. Bush by just a handful of votes in one state. He still, once those court cases had worked their way through the United States court system, he did step back and say, no, George W. Bush is the president of the United States. That's one of the cornerstones of our democracy, is to have that peaceful transfer of power. And what we saw happen in the last few months here in the United States is that President Trump wasn't willing to abide by that standard because he was alleging election fraud in so many states across the nation. Now, we know that President Trump fought those court cases, and he lost every single one of them. There were numerous recounts, and everybody went through the democratic process to make sure that every vote was counted. And when those votes were counted, Joe Biden was certified as the winner of that election. Unfortunately, President Trump chose not to accept that result. And we saw the result on Capitol Hill on January 6th when his supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol and put it under siege.
So how would you characterize this particular transition of election, would you characterize it as having been a smooth transition of power from President John Trump to President Joe Biden?
Not in the least. I would actually say that it was one of the most unsettled transfers of power in American history, and certainly the most unsettled transfer of power in my lifetime that most people have seen in politics in the U.S. There's really no precedent for a president's supporters storming another branch of government. Remember, the U.S. Congress is a separate, co-equal branch of government to the White House. President Trump allegedly incited his supporters to go into that Capitol and stop the democratic process of counting votes. Now, I should note that we've just been through an impeachment process here in the United States when the U.S. Senate held a trial to decide whether or not Trump had actually incited those rioters. Seven Republicans and with 50 Democrats to say that President Trump was indeed guilty, but that didn't meet the two-thirds majority standard needed to convict Trump and bar him from ever running for office again. So the big question here in the United States is, what will President Trump do next? Will he want to run again in 2024? He said that he wants to keep his movement going. That would be a highly unusual turn to have a president go out of office and then run again for the presidency. But as we know, every former President Trump has been unusual and unprecedented.
You know, Catherine, before we came on air, we were talking about the significance of democracy. I told you that I recall a former great British Prime Minister, Sir Winston Churchill, talking about how democracy, in his view, was perhaps the worst form of government except for the other ones. I have been wondering, if Winston Churchill were alive today, what would he have said about the type of democracy that we experienced recently in the United States of America?
I love this question, and I would pay just about anything to hear what Winston Churchill would say about our situation right now. I know that everyone around the world is looking to the United States of America. We have been telling people in other countries how to run their democracies for decades. And now they're looking to us after these shocking scenes at the U.S. Capitol, and they know that's not democracy when police are being beaten, when windows are being smashed in, when the U.S. Capitol, one of the cornerstones of our democracy, is being looted. This is not the process that includes all of the American people into saying who their president is. We already had that process last November. It was settled, and we cannot be living in constant fear that one mob from any side, left, right, Democratic, or Republican, will come in and storm their way through to get what they want. That's not the democratic process, even if it is the worst form of government other than the others, like Churchill said.
Interesting. Final question, Catherine. Where do we go from here?
I think the Republican Party is wrestling with itself right now. If they had voted to convict former President Trump, then he would have been barred from running for office ever again. He would have been a non-person in the Republican Party. Now they haven't fully resolved that question for themselves. They could have President Trump going out on the campaign trail, campaigning for his Republican candidates, and going up against the Republicans that he doesn't like. He is already in a huge battle with Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell. They are trading insults back and forth. And this isn't good for the party. Democrats are going to be looking on the sidelines and thinking, well, how can we make the most of this, all of this disarray in the Republican Party? But never underestimate former President Trump's ability to bring out that base of voters who are passionate about him. This is going to be very interesting to watch in the next few months and years.
Thank you very, very much for your insight, Catherine.
You're so very welcome. Good to be here.
Now we go for the other part of the African perspective. Now, Pauline Muchina.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Well, like I said earlier, it is a great pleasure to have the opportunity to host you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you. Yep. I'm excited about it.
Yes, indeed. Now, Pauline, you've been watching the events surrounding the controversial, or at least what is characterized as the controversial recent U.S. presidential elections. Do you agree with that characterization that indeed these elections were controversial? And if so, why?
Thank you very much, Shaka. I do believe these elections were controversial because President Trump decided way before the elections that he was going to win the elections with a landslide. And this was in spite of all the election polls that were being done during that time. So he actually decided to tell the public that he was not going to accept the election results, no matter who wins, especially if he loses. So he decided that he was going to be the president before even the elections. So for me, that was controversial.
Interesting. What about you, Claude?
I agree with Pauline, but to start with, Shaka, I just wanted to compliment you both on your jacket in I love your how you're representing Africa here. Also, it's a great honor to be here with Pauline because, you know, she is my one of my colleagues. Do a lot of advocacy work with her through ADNA. I agree with Pauline that the election was controversial because, first, for one reason. One is because former President Trump decided that he was going to win before he even ran. And that is, to me, you know, it's not unique, obviously. You know, it happens in a lot of places. But that is not what normally happens in America. For second thing is I would like to use an analogy that we use in football, or as the Americans call it, soccer. It's when you go play the game, you need to make sure that you win so convincingly that the referees are a non-factor. So he kept haggling over every, you know, counting every vote and realized that, yes, every vote matters, and he lost. Then after losing, he continued to drag the process to the point where his supporters violently invaded the Capitol. And that is also, for the Capitol, it's unprecedented. But in America, that kind of violence is actually not that unprecedented. This is what I kept, you know, sharing with people who would say they were surprised, but then these type of riots, we have seen them throughout history in America. So the controversy to me was not only Trump declaring himself that he had won before he even ran in the election, two, not winning convincingly enough to where he needed to drag out the process, and still he came out on the losing end. And three, the reaction, the global reaction to, oh, how surprising that this is happening to in America. It's not surprising. We've seen this type of riots every time there is a, for example, championship games, you know, NCAA, NBA, various championship games. After championship games, there's riots, there's destruction of property and violence. And even, you know, with just the history of Black people in America, where people have been hung, you know, those type of things. To me, the riot was not as surprising as the world made it out to be. So all the controversy was, you know, to do with what Trump did, what happened with the result, and the reaction around the globe.
Pauline, to what extent did you think that democracy, or at least the type of American democracy, could in fact prove to be very fragile?
It was before the elections when he actually declared he was going to win, even before the elections. But also when he realized that he had lost the elections, instead of conceding, he declared that he had won. And instead of just declaring himself, he actually did everything within his power to challenge those elections. And, you know, he tried with the courts. When the courts did not work, actually used his own supporters to intimidate policymakers, including the vice president of this country, who, when they were counting or when they were heading into certifying the elections. When I see that, you know, I thought to myself, my goodness, we're going to have violence like we usually have in Kenya, where I come from, or other parts of African countries. And I'm thinking, what is really going to stop this kind of violence in this country? And for a while there, actually very sad to see Republicans, especially, not pushing back and telling President Trump what he was doing was wrong and he needs to stop and accept the results that people have in President Biden, and he should step back. And there wasn't that much pushing from the Republican Party. So I don't only hold President Trump accountable, I also hold the Republican Party accountable for not standing up for the Constitution of the United States.
Claude, when you think about what happened in the nation's capital on January 6th, when supporters of President Trump literally invaded the Capitol Hill Congress to stop the certification of the president-elect Joe Biden. Did you think that you were looking, in fact, at the United States of America, or did you think that perhaps you were looking at some country somewhere on the African continent or somewhere in Asia?
Yeah, my answer is yes and no. Again, on one hand, because it was the capital, because the invasions are usually not toward federal or government institutions, except with the biggest one being the Oklahoma bombing by, if I remember correctly, Timothy McVeigh in 1993, I believe, the Oklahoma City bombing of the federal building. I think this one was, you know, so there is some history in America of invasions or violence on government property, but not to this extent where you have a mob basically jumping in for the purpose of stopping the certification and the result of an election. So on one hand, yes, I kind of saw, you know, America has a history of this. You know, you look at, you know, even, you know, starting from the beginning with the Native Americans, and you come all the way to history to here, and I can see that. But on the other hand, we are not used to seeing this as part of an election. This is not even so. When you ask about fragility, I thought about the DNC in 2016, and the Democratic National Committee, when there was controversy between the right candidate or the candidate Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. There was no violence. So this is unprecedented in terms of this being a part of an election. And it did look like what we were used to seeing during elections on the African continent. And sometimes, or a lot of times, it's by the state. That, I think, a lot of times is a little bit of the difference, because these were Trump candidates, supporters, but not necessarily supported by the government itself, although we know now that there were members of law enforcement that were part of the mob that stormed the Capitol. But you think about, for example, what just happened in Uganda, you know, the disgrace that just took place in Uganda, that's called an election, which I'm not sure that election is the right word to use. And people were assaulted, killed, hit by cars. And the military was parading around town, intimidating people from removing the incumbent. So the behavior of President Trump is similar to a lot of incumbents, especially long-serving dictators on the African continent. And, you know, I just gave the example of Uganda. We've seen this in the Congo. We've seen this in Rwanda. There's been violence at every election in Kenya, 2007. Being the worst that I, at least since Kenya became a democratic country in 2002, and Pauline, feel free to correct me there. But we've seen this on the African continent in multiple places where the incumbent uses violence to control the results, and that's what it reminded me of, and that's why my answer was yes and no. Yes, it looked like not America, but a country in Africa or Asia, but also historically thinking about the history of the U.S., that this is not so unprecedented in terms of this type of mob violence.
Trump did use his power to perpetrate the violence. So it was state-sponsored in that sense, because he refused to call the come and stop that violence. And the members of Congress were pleading with him. Other staff members were pleading with him, telling him, please call the National Guard. And he wouldn't do that. So that, to me, that violence was state-sponsored by the President of United States, because he refused to call the National Guard to quell or to stop them from the violence that they were already perpetuating. And think about it. For many, many months during Trump's tenure, he promoted violence. You know, when the Charlottesville incident happened, you know, he called white supremacists who were so violent, he called them, you know, good, you know. And when you know, abused and hit people in his rallies, he said, kick them out or punch them, you know. And along the lines, it looked like the United States of America was promoting a violent approach to elections in this country.
You know, Claude, for me, it clearly reminded me of what happened in 2010 in the Ivory Coast, when Laurent Gbagbo essentially refused to concede defeat to an election that had apparently been won by his opponent, Alassane Ouattara.
That's right. It was very similar. And I'm trying to think of other examples on the African continent, but what ended up happening was actually happened in the Ivory Coast even before that. When Gbagbo came into power, so this was the second round of it. When he came into power, there had been a coup by General Gueye, and they had an election, and General Gueye declared himself the winner against the voices of the people. Gbagbo had won, and he was violently removed and killed. And then Gbagbo took over. And then when it was his time to leave, he refused to leave. And he was also violently removed by the French. However, you are correct. It looked very, very, very similar, where basically he was barricading himself behind his supporters to keep himself in the presidential seat. So Laurent Gbagbo did it. Trump did it. Gueye before Gbagbo did it, and it's a shame, because what happened in January is going to have a domino effect. It's going to embolden these types of misleaders that want to stay and overstay and continue to stay in power using, and Pauline, thank you for the correction, using state resources, state power, to keep themselves in the seats, refusing to concede the loss of elections. And when they actually have the power, fortunately, Trump didn't have the amount of power that a lot of these African dictators have, you know, the firepower, and he didn't have control of the guns and all of the money. But for somebody who has control of all the guns and the money, it's going to be very difficult, and they're going to say what happened in America, you know. And when the U.S. starts saying, hey, you know, you need to concede the election, they're going to say, you just did it. How can you now lecture us?
I mean, Pauline, if you were to talk to me from the deepest, better part of the Kenyan heart and soul, why should this really happen in the United States of America, a land which has practiced democracy for more than four centuries, and a land that has a sort of democracy that has the inbuilt checks and balances, where you have strong institutions and a society that in fact is run on the basis of law rather than on the basis of man?
Shaka, democracy is fragile in any part of the world. That's the first part. The second part, the fact that an individual can be so powerful and decides to hold on to power based on their own self-interests and forget the interests of the people. And they will do everything possible to even change the constitutions of the constitution of a country, as it has happened in African countries like, you know, Uganda and other parts of Africa where they've changed the constitution so that they can stay in power for longer. So here in the United States, we saw that in play, an individual trying to work so hard to stay in power. And the only thing that held him back is institutions that have been in place in this country for decades. And that's the division of the three, you know, branches of government, you know, Congress, the judiciary, and the administration. They were very clear and they had different roles. And therefore, it was an individual trying to hold on to power, but was confronted by Congress, was confronted by his own judiciary. You know, the Attorney General William Barr actually said that the elections were fair. You know, we had some people in his own administration, FBI, saying that this was the safest election in the history of the United States. So because there were institutions and because there were people willing to stand on behalf of the Constitution, then he was not able to overcome. But even as we move now, there is a huge challenge that now individuals in the United States, including Trump himself, know that they can actually take those institutions and maybe the next time they will succeed. That's probably what they are thinking. But I hope that these institutions will hold firm, and they will hold firm by holding people accountable, like Mr. Trump held accountable by the judiciary system here in the United States for the wrongs that he committed to incite violence. Without that ability, the institution in place or the mechanism in place will be weakened. So this is the time for United States policymakers to understand that, and the judiciary system to understand that they are not just holding Mr. Trump and his followers accountable, but they are holding generations of leaders to come accountable to make sure that nobody tries to grab power by force. And if they don't loop by holding them accountable, then they will become like other countries from where we come from, where a president can declare himself a president for life, you know, or can try to stay in power as long as he can hold on to, you know, and then, you know, they can use coups to come into power. They can use anything. I don't know whether this is something that the United States has forgotten. Heading into the election, and this I'm speaking from a nonviolent perspective, because American Friends Services Committee believes in a nonviolent approach to conflict resolution. But right before the elections, we saw people in official positions, appointed to positions, including being fired, being shifted to other parts, so that it felt like they were preparing to have even the military backing, you know. And when you think of the protesters who happened at the White House and they used the military, they use tear gas, you know, to disperse a nonviolent protest. I mean, a crowd of protesters tells me that this was prepared to go all the way. Fortunately, the system held, but for how long?
Interesting. You're watching Straight Talk Africa, and we'll be right back with you. So please, don't go away.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living. right here on VOA.
Hello, welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. And today, we reflect on the recent controversial American presidential elections from an African perspective. My guests are Pauline Muchina, Public Education and Advocacy Coordinator for the Africa region at the American Friends Service Committee, and Claude Gatebuche, Executive Director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Claude, of course, as your fellow panelist says, the system essentially did work. In other words, at least for now, democracy, or American type of democracy, has proven to be resilient. And as she asks, for how long? Any particular reason, for example, why the then president, Donald J. Trump, had taken an oath in office to protect the United States of America against foreign and domestic enemies? Any particular reason why he did not, for example, stand by that oath and protect the Americans, especially from what appears to be the rising domestic terrorists?
So I love the way you put it when you say American type of democracy. I just want to add American type of democracy in America, because we know that America also has a long history of supporting tyrants around the world, friendly tyrants. I think there is it's subject to interpretation, and former President Donald Trump basically took his own interpretation of what he calls enemies, you know, external and internal
domestic
enemies.
Yeah.
Yeah, domestic enemies. And what he considers domestic enemies are the people who voted against him, or the choice of the Americans, versus, you know, his supporters. He does not consider his supporters domestic enemies or domestic terrorists. Again, Pauline talked about it. When the white supremacist in Charlottesville violently killed people, and they violently protested, he said that they were good people, that they were good people. Whenever there is violence, he generally sides with his political, whatever his political views are, he will support the violence or go against the violence. And it's a great example that Pauline gave. It's not just the protest at the White House, but around in various parts of America, there has been violence unleashed against protesters, Black Lives Matter protesters, protesting state-sanctioned violence, state violence by the police, killing mostly unarmed Black people in various parts. And every time this happens, he says, oh, bring in the National Guard, you know, bring, you need to take a hard stance and everything. But when it comes to his supporters, he does not consider them domestic terrorists, which I think is correct. They are domestic terrorists. But to him, he takes a personal interpretation, which the oath that you're talking about, for me, my understanding of it, the oath is about the country, not about him. But he makes things about him, himself. And that's the difference versus, you know, protecting the country from foreign and domestic enemies is foreign and domestic enemies of his personally, whatever he interprets as enemies for himself, versus what are real enemies of America. And I think that is, to me, the difference.
You know, there can never be democracy unless democracy is defined by accountability and justice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent, for example, should former President Donald J. Trump, to what extent should he in fact be made to be accountable to the American people, given that when he was impeached by the House of Representatives, the Senate failed by 10 votes to convict him?
The fact that he was not convicted is going to protect him from actually facing accountability as other people would. And I really hope that there's going to be a mechanism that pushes for him to be held accountable and his supporters that invaded Congress, because anytime you do not reward bad behavior. If you reward bad behavior with basically letting him get away with it without any accountability, then it's bound to repeat. And that's why Pauline's question is very, very relevant in for how long. Unless there is accountability, unless any kind of bad behavior that is tolerated, that's what people will do. People will do what they can get away with. And so Trump will do what he can get away with. He's still eligible to run again. And I just think it's bad for the country. It's similar to what's happened historically with police violence towards black people, where they just get away with it. Every time somebody gets away with it, the next person thinks they can get away with it. That's here in America, and it's around the world, where people who use violence and get away with it and have impunity or immunity will continue to do that. And so I my hope is that there will be a mechanism that holds him accountable to the full extent of any person that incites violence like that. What happens to them? What is the punishment? What is the legal punishment for a person that does that? And that's how former President Donald Trump should be treated.
And there is a mechanism, which is the judiciary system in this country. And I'm really glad to see Georgia, New York, D.C. Taking steps to investigate and try to hold not only the insurrectors accountable, but the inciters to violence. So this judiciary system is supposed to hold anybody. There is nobody who is above the law in this country, you know. So even the former president has to face the judiciary system in this country, answer for his own actions. You know, the actions of especially picking up the phone and calling officials in states like Georgia, telling them to overturn the election on his behalf. You know, calling members of when they are being attacked to tell them not to ratify elections. There ought to be a law in this country that decides that no, any individual, whether president or a regular citizen, who tries to attack the election system using violence or coercion has to be held accountable. And that's what we lack in some of our countries, where, you know, a lot of political leaders, you know, they will commit violence, including murder, to stay in power. And unfortunately, our judiciary systems are not independent of the political system in the country. So whoever controls the political system also controls the judiciary system, and therefore nobody to hold you accountable. I have hope in this country that the judiciary system, and especially it is organized so that the state attorney generals, the state judiciary system are independent from the federal judiciary system. I think there is hope that he will be held accountable, and anybody else who lied about elections. Look at the companies like Dominion that manufactured the election machines, you know, are already taking them to court for lying about their machines or lying about them trying to rig the elections for Joe Biden. So the election, the judiciary system here, I think, will do its job. And for all of our sake, I hope it does its job.
I think that the trick here really is that the reason the system works here is that you have three co-equal branches of government. And each of them, whether you are talking about the legislature, which is made up of Congress, the House of Representatives, and the Senate, whether you are talking about the judiciary, the Supreme Court of the land, for example, and of course the executive, which is headed by the president, they basically function in a manner that allows them to practice a sort of checks and balances. And I think that despite the fact that a lot of judges had in fact been appointed by President Trump himself, when he sent some of his allegations to them, they were able to fiercely guard their independence and basically called it like it was, using the facts and the law by throwing a lot of the allegations out. To what extent would you, for example, say that there is a need, when you look across the African continent, that there is a need in many African countries for, in fact, borrowing at least from that template of the United States aspect of democracy into their governance system?
I think it's highly needed, highly, highly needed, to where today in many countries, if we can just look at the belt of Africa, starting from the Horn of Africa and go all the way across to Gabon, down to Angola, and all the way back across to Tanzania. There's probably like 15 countries in that area. So many of those countries are struggling because institutions are not strong enough to have the checks and balances. You know, you look at places like Sudan, South Sudan, Uganda, Rwanda, Congo, Gabon, you know, the Congo Republic, the Central African Republic. I mean, and I can go on. And basically, power is in the hands of the president. The president controls everything. I spoke about Uganda a little bit earlier, where Museveni, who's been in power for 35 years now, he changed the constitution so he could change the age limit and make himself eligible to run. And then he ran an election where the military was basically controlling the people and held up and held his main opponent in under house arrest. And for me, things like that, and you were seeing things like that happen, by the way, even in Rwanda, where you can't say anything about the president. And whatever he decides, if he says that you're going to be convicted, by the way, there's a lady who's been arrested for speaking out and calling out the injustices in Rwanda. Her name is Ida Mange, just this Monday. Anytime you speak out against him and he decides that you're going to spend the time in prison, you're going to spend time in prison. He said it about Diane Rwigara, who ran against him in 2017, a woman who ran against him in 2017, Victoire Ingabire in 2010, Kizito Mihigo, who actually was declared dead a year ago today in a prison cell in Rwanda for basically calling out crimes that the government committed. He also called him out and said, I'm not a singer that praises the opposition, and he called for him to be imprisoned. And then he turns around and pardons them. That's controlling the institutions. You know, this is a judiciary. If there's a judiciary issue, it should be a judiciary issue. The president should have nothing to do with it. Congress should not have nothing to do with it, or parliament in the case of countries like Uganda and Rwanda. I'm using those examples. Those should be independent, but they are not independent, and we need that. We highly need that. In spite of my skepticism of what the judiciary would do with Trump, given the history in America of the judiciary siding with white supremacy. And so many recent examples of, again, I like to refer to when police kill black people, what happens. However, in Africa, in especially the belt, that's what I call it, there is a high need for institutions that come even near as close to the institutions that there are in America in terms of independence.
I'm afraid that when you use the examples like Uganda and Rwanda, you may run into very, very strong resistance, because those two particular individuals that you have mentioned say that, in fact, they are staying longer at the political harem of their countries precisely because their people want them to do that. In fact, they say that they and their families are sacrificing for the countries, that they wouldn't even want to be there 1 minute longer, except that they are succumbing to the pressure from their people, because their people apparently cannot quite do really without their stewards, you know, without them.
That's unacceptable, because in most cases, they are doing everything possible to suppress the opposition in those countries. So if the people want to stay in power, why don't they allow the opposition also to campaign and run for office equally, and then also have just and fair elections? And let the people decide. They don't allow that. They actually jail or, you know, prevent house arrest for the opposition before the elections and even during the elections, so that they are the only one who is going to win those elections. So I don't think they are staying there for the people. They are staying there for power. Who are electing them, because when people in their country start protesting, they use violence to stop them from protesting against them. If they really believe people love them, then why don't you let who are protesting protest, and then go to let the polls decide who is the right leader of that particular country.
Pauline, how do you reconcile your criticism with the fact that in the case of the Rwandan ruler, some might suggest, last time when they conducted a referendum, the man virtually got something close to a perfect score? Almost 100%.
Was it a just referendum? Were people free to vote? Did they feel intimidated? Did they know that they, no matter how they vote, whether to have continue or not to continue, there would be no repercussions. You know, the experiences of people in a country like Rwanda or other countries in Africa know that if you vote against the ruling party, against the ruling president, you're in for it. And you will pay with your blood, you know. And so people vote, you know, sometimes even let him continue. If that's going to help us stay, you know, alive, let him continue. So I question the referendums that happen. And I question some of the practices, like in the country of Kenya, where, you know, if a president is angry with the politicians who have opposed him, you know, he goes to Congress, they kick them out. You know, they kick them out from the ruling party because they question, for example, the BBI. That is in Kenya. You know, when they have the referendum on BBI in Kenya, you know, they... But look at the intimidation that is taking place now. You have to count all human beings fear for their lives. Human beings fear for their generations to come. So they are not going to do anything that will jeopardize that. Sometimes, yes, they gain, they fight, I mean, they protests and they push back. But most of the times, people will stand back because they know the repercussions will be negative.
I think that there are some exceptions which we could probably note, especially with regards to the judiciary system. We know, for example, that during the last election, you had the Kenyan Supreme Court stand up.
Yes.
I think that was some progress. In the last election in Malawi, you had the Supreme Court stand up. And Malawi, better than Kenya, the rerun actually was conducted in such a way that it provided essentially what you would call justified competition, a competition that resulted in fact in turning tables. The opposition ended up in fact winning the presidency. So I think it could happen. Unfortunately, in most of other countries across the continent, yes, you do have checks and balances reflected on paper. But when it comes to the reality of real politics, you have the executive led by a president who basically functions as if he is the Superman, in the sense that the national assemblies, the judiciary systems, merely become his subsidiaries.
That's
how
right.
could that possibly be changed?
And I think that for that to change, it's going to take resistance. It's going to take people really taking a stand and pushing, because these dictators are not going to change on their own. They're not going to change what they do. It's going to take a global effort, internal and external. The issues that we have in a lot of the African countries are both internal in terms of the dictatorship and the power that they have, but also the external support that they get a lot of times from Western countries. And so they have all this power. They use it against the people. In cases, when Pauline was speaking, I just thought about the elections in Liberia in years ago when Charles Taylor was running, and people were saying, he killed my mom, he killed my pa, but I will vote for him anyway. That's what happens in countries like Uganda and Rwanda especially, where almost virtually everybody's had somebody killed by the regime, and so they're afraid that they would be killed. But I was very excited and actually happy to see the result in Malawi. I was very nervous for it, seeing the violence during the election violence, but the turn of events was great. But Malawi has been making progressive changes toward a democratic and an accountable system. And I think it also is going to take not only internal people taking a stance, but the regions themselves taking a stance, and the whole continent, taking a stand, and the globe taking a stance toward these people. Because I think the South African influence in the region that Malawi is in, Southern Africa, is it is the most democratic part or region of Africa of all the regions on the continent. And I think that has a lot of influence.
Pauline, there used to be a time when military coups were in vogue in Africa. And indeed, across the developing world. But it reached a point where the international community essentially drew a line in the sand and said, if you seize power by means of AK-47, tanks, and you know it, and whatever it is, we are not going to do business with you as usual. Any particular reason, for example, why the international community does not use that same policy about, for example, elections that really are not elections, but they are selections of an incumbent president who essentially controls everything you can think about. If that particular individual steals an election, rigs an election, or changes constitutions, and there is evidence to the contrary, why can't, for example, the international community adopt that policy that we are not going to do business with you as usual, because stealing an election is tantamount to treason, precisely because, in fact, it is stealing a country.
The self-interest of the United States, for example, or European Union, or any other country in the world, actually determines whether they will hold a particular leader accountable to his misdeeds. Because they say that it is better to have that particular in place to protect their rather than, you know, having that person because they stole the elections. So I think what we as an organization, as Advocacy Network for Africa, American Friends Service, that we push that the self-interest of a particular country has to put into consideration the well-being of the citizens of that particular country. Because if they don't, they are using their own self-interest to continue suppressing, you know, people around the world, including some of the African countries, you know, where they could add democracy if American or European countries were not involved, you know, or they actually those leaders accountable. But it is not happening because they keep propping those leaders by giving them financial aid and actually by pushing back on the opposition when the opposition in those countries stand up and say, we need to make a difference in our country. Ask for the United States, for example, not to support leaders who have stolen elections, who are using violence to suppress their own. Like, you know, that he takes money either from the U.S. or any other and use it for their self-interest, you know, buy military capability to suppress its own people. We call on them to stop doing that.
Unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, time is not our best ally. And for that, I have to frankly say again that I was profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have had the opportunity to host the two of you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you so much, Shaka. It was a great pleasure.
Thanks to our audience for joining our conversation on Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please, please, let's keep the African hopes alive. Thank you.